The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from Jason Furman, former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama.
It is now my privilege to introduce our guest speaker. When our guest today was named chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, the CEA, by former President Barack Obama, the appointment would represent a culmination of his career working for Obama and before him, President Bill Clinton. Jason Furman was one of Obama's top advisors during his 2008 presidential campaign, where he served as economic policy director. During his chairman of the CEA nomination remarks, Obama referred to Furman as, quote, one of the most brilliant economic minds of his generation, end quote. Growing up in Greenwich Village in New York City, Furman showed an early interest and aptitude for economics by tracking stocks throughout high school, becoming an avid reader of The Economist at the young age of 13, and volunteering on the Walter Mondale campaign in the ninth grade. This was just the beginning of a path of success in his field, where he excelled at Harvard in both undergraduate and graduate studies. Jason also excelled in his graduate studies at the London School of Economics. And here's a fun fact for you. Jason and the actor Matt Damon of Good Will Hunting and Jason Bourne fame were freshman roommates at Harvard. Don't worry, economists are much cooler than movie stars in this room here. As a graduate student, Furman began working in the Clinton administration as an economist on the CEA and by doing public policy work at the World Bank. In the Obama White House, Furman was instrumental in helping that administration maintain a low inflation rate, cut the federal deficit by two-thirds, reduce the unemployment rate, and expand exports. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Furman held a variety of public policy and research posts, including stints as a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Now living a civilian life in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Furman continues to make a big impact as a professor of the practice of economic policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and as a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He also holds a PhD in economics from Harvard. Please join me in welcoming Jason Furman. Have fun.
Thanks much. So thanks so much for that introduction, and thanks for having me here. So I particularly want to thank Al Hubbard for reaching out to invite me here. We had heard of each other many years before we knew each other. I knew him as somebody that was trying to help President Bush do diabolical things to the Social Security system. And he knew me as somebody that kept coming out with diabolical analyses of the wonderful things that they were trying to do to the Social Security system. And then we first met about 7 years ago at the American Enterprise Institute, a free market-oriented think tank. Holds an annual meeting, and they were always kind enough to invite me when I was in the government because they thought it was very important to engage across the ideological spectrum. And I met Al there, and I think both of us are very much believe in the importance of that type of engagement and the role that rational discourse can play in better policymaking. And it's my belief in the role that rational discourse can play in better policymaking that caused me to flee from Washington, D.C. 8 months ago and brought me here to Indiana today. So I should say the last time I was in Indiana, I got to fly here and back on Air Force One, but the Economic Club was not able to arrange that for me this time. So, as you know, President Obama had a fondness for Elkhart, Indiana. So, want to talk about, you know, where we are in the economy right now. The short-run economic situation is, I think, the dullest it's been for a really long time. And that's great news. It's dull because the unemployment rate, and here I'm showing you underemployment, so this includes discouraged workers, people working part-time, the broadest measure you could possibly have, is back below where it was prior to the last recession. The inflation rate is a little bit below the Fed's target for inflation. They try to have inflation of 2%. It's around 1.5% right now. And if you look at real wages, they've been growing pretty steadily since about the beginning of 2012, with a bit of ups and downs related largely to oil. The growth rate in the last quarter, of course, was 3.1%. And so the current debates that are going on right now around monetary policy, when will the Fed raise rates, what are they doing with their balance sheet, what are we doing with short-run fiscal policy, those are all interesting and important, but I don't think they're the most interesting and important set of issues that we're facing in the economy today. What I think is the most interesting and important set of issues that we face in the economy today is that for many decades, we have seen subpar income growth. And this chart shows you that from 1948 through 1973, the median family saw its income go up at 3% every year. When your income goes up at 3% every year, that means it doubles every 20 or 25 years. So once a generation, your income would double. Since 1973, the typical family has seen its income rise by 0.4% per year. And, you know, per the conversation I had about Al and I, that line runs through a lot of Democratic presidents, a lot of Republican presidents. This isn't the, you know, this president's policy that you hated or that president's policy that you hated. It's been happening for a long time now. And at 0.4% a year, it takes about 150 years for incomes to double. So instead of doubling every generation, they're doubling every 150 years. There's a debate about whether we're measuring these statistics correctly. I'm happy to talk more about that in the Q&A if we want. I think it's possible that we're not measuring them exactly right and that that 3 should really be a higher number, maybe 4, and that 0.4 should really be a high number, maybe 1.4. But I don't think that would change the conclusion that income growth has slowed a lot. So this question is really big part of the debate in our political system and a big part of what has really exercised me in trying to understand what's causing it and what could be done about it. To help figure out what's causing it, I did a thought experiment. And the first part of the thought experiment is, you know, we know two things happened around 1973. Productivity growth slowed down and inequality started to rise. So I asked the question, you know, what role are both of these factors playing? And so the first thought experiment I did was, what if inequality had not risen since 1973? What would have happened to incomes? And the answer is that incomes would have gone up according to that blue line you see there. The typical family would have had an extra $12,000. They would have had incomes that were 17%. Higher. I then asked a different question. That question was, what if inequality had increased just like it did, but instead we had continued with the really high levels of productivity growth we had in the 50s and 60s? What would family incomes have been then? The answer is they would have been $47,000 higher, or 67% higher. If you combine it and said, what if inequality hadn't increased and productivity hadn't fallen, you get an extra $67,000. That would mean incomes would be double what they actually were. Now, I don't think any set of policies from 1973 on could have gotten you the whole extra $67,000, but potentially could have gotten more of it. This exercise, for me, highlights the importance of productivity growth and economic growth. That's been a big part of why income growth has been slow. and we're not going to be able to solve income growth without faster productivity growth. In fact, you look at real wages right now, they're growing, but a lot are disappointed with the amount of real wage growth. Real wages are growing at about 1% right now. Problem is, productivity is also growing at about 1% right now, and you can't have sustained wage growth faster than your productivity growth, because that gives you the total amount that you can give out. So without faster productivity growth, we're not going to be able to have faster wage growth. It's a big part of the problem. But the other conclusion I take from this is the inequality portion of this was $12,000. And $12,000 is a lot of money. And we may have some policy instruments that could help us address inequality. And so we want to be doing that too. And insofar as we can figure out ways to increase growth while reducing inequality, that's even better. So let's talk now a little bit about what I see as the three factors going on here. The first is productivity, the second is inequality, and the third, which I haven't introduced yet but we'll come back to, is labor force participation, the fraction of the population that's working. So the first thing to understand about productivity growth is since 1973, it's been pretty bad. Over the last decade, it's been quite bad. And it's been quite bad across all of the advanced economies. I think Spain is the only one out of 30 advanced economies that hasn't seen its productivity growth fall. The United States there, if you squint, you'll notice that our red bar, which is productivity growth over the last decade, is a tiny smidge higher than anyone else in the G7. But I wouldn't get too excited about that because all of those red bars are too low. All of those red bars are below the blue bar. This is probably the most important thing happening in the economy right now. It's not fully understood. There's probably a lot of things going on. One thing that we know is going on here, which is actually sort of comforting, is that when you have a large financial crisis, that leads to slower productivity growth for a period of time. You see this going back decades, even centuries. You see it in a wide range of countries. It happens because businesses invest less, because consumers pull back and you don't have the demand you need to justify that investment. It happens because the financial system freezes up initially and won't make loans. And it happens because in a recession, you even miss out on a lot of R&D and other things you need for your future growth. So part of what's going on is that. That's the good news part of what's going on, because it means that as we get further away from the recession, we'll recover. One way to see that is that capital deepening, that's the amount of capital services that you get as a result of investment, have fallen per worker in all of the advanced economies. But if you look at the latest data over the last couple quarters, that's actually picked up to some degree. There's another more worrying possibility, though, that's going on with the productivity numbers, which is that there's a lot of evidence that it's increasingly hard to come up with ideas. Now, it's hard to imagine this. We hear about artificial intelligence, personalized medicine, new genome sequencing techniques, advanced materials, all of these things, and I'm excited about all of them. But when you add them all up, you're still not seeing them in the economic data in the way that you would like to. And part of that is, it's a little bit complicated, so I'll explain it, is that blue bar there is the amount of total factor productivity growth we've had over the last 80 years. And that's the measure of how much innovation we're getting out of the economy. That green line is one way to measure how much effort we're putting into that innovation. And the answer is that we have a lot more people engaged in research today producing the same amount of innovation that a much smaller number of people had before. It's not just the aggregate data. If you look, for example, at research in treating cancer or other diseases, research in producing more yield from soybean fields, there's a lot more scientists working in those areas today, a lot more clinical trials, a lot more papers written, And we continue to make progress on mortality and cancer, but despite having more researchers on it than ever before, we're actually making progress at a bit of a slower rate because some of the easier ideas were the ones we had before. Same thing with agricultural yields and a variety of other things in the economy. If you believe that, that's a scary hypothesis for the future. It's not one that I'm 100% sure is right, but it's one that I'm increasingly worried about. And it's scary because when you look at our future economic growth, it's compounded by another issue, which is that our population is aging. This shows the fraction of the population that I'm going to continue to refer to as prime age, following the standard word in the literature. I may stop using that word in about 8 years. But I'll keep using it for now. And this is sort of a lot of economic growth comes from this group. This is a group that works at very high rates, that contributes to the economy at very high rates. It's a group that was growing at 2% a year in the 1980s. It's now growing at about 0% a year. And if I showed you a graph for China, for the United Kingdom, for India, it would look roughly the same as these. The Chinese graph actually looks much more extreme. And so this is something that, in addition to the productivity growth, for economic growth, we're very much grappling with not having the same favorable demographic headwinds we had for a long time. So in continuing this whirlwind tour, factor number two is inequality. In the United States, we're the number one productivity growth in the last decade. We're also the number one in terms of the level and increase in inequality as measured by the share of income for the top 1%. One of those is probably a good thing. The other one, at least personally, I'm less than thrilled about. But you see that increase in inequality across a wide range of countries, but that red line is the United States. It is considerably more. Now, when you talk about the top 1%, especially if you work for a Democratic administration, it starts to sound a little class warfare-y and, you know, what do you have against top 1%? So I'll invert that and say, you know, the bottom 90% used to get 2/3 of the income. Now we're getting half of the income. And it's hard to have the type of income growth you want if your share of the pie is shrinking from 2/3 to 1/2. If economic growth had picked up a lot, that might be okay, but in a world of slowing economic growth, this compounds the problem. Try and understand the causes of inequality. I think most of it is explained by supply and demand. In particular, there's more of a demand for skilled workers than there was before, and we're actually not producing as many skilled workers at the same rate that we used to. This shows the average number of years of schooling in the workforce. And from 1875 through 1950, these are people born in those years. So if you're born in 1950, you're entering the workforce in the 1970s, or if you went to lots of graduate school, 1980s. This reflects the fact that high school became universal from between World War I and World War II. That after World War II, we had the GI Bill. We then had deferments from the Vietnam War. We had a lot of things that were increasing the amount of education. But then all of that stopped. And we're still increasing education, but we're not increasing it at nearly the rate that we're used to, at the same time that computers, robots, other technologies really raise the return and the value of education. And so that, what one economist called the race between education and technology, technology has been winning. It's a big premium for people with a college education and a big increase in inequality. I think the other set of reasons for rising inequality are what I would call non-competitive or institutional explanations. And I think that the fact that the real value of the minimum wage has fallen is an important part of the story, especially for women who are disproportionately on the minimum wage, and is an important part of the story around the 10th percentile. Declining union membership as a share of employment is probably linked to rising inequality, and some other issues about perhaps less competition and more consolidation across our economy, giving leverage to employers over employees. I think there's a set of causes of inequality. The last factor that I wanted to put down, which since about 2000 has been an important part of the story, is labor force participation. That's the fraction of people who are either in a job or looking for a job. And if you look, once again, I'm going to look at prime age men, so we're not being affected by the demography of people retiring or students not working. It's a group, 25 to 54, that largely you would expect would be working. And in the 1950s, 98% of them were either working or looking for a job. Now we're down to 88%. This just shows the overall number. If we looked at the number for high school or less, that used to be about the same as a college degree. They used to be in the workforce about the same. The high school or less has now fallen to about 80%. So one out of five men in this age group, about 7 million of them, have given up looking for work entirely. This is a macroeconomic problem because we're missing the output from these people. We have a problem with an aging population, and we're not making use of a lot of our population that's not aging. I think it's an even bigger social problem because this isn't just that your income isn't growing as quickly as someone else's. There's a real degree of exclusion from society that plays out here. This problem has been going on for a long time, and it's much worse in the United States than it is most anywhere else. Women have had the same experience, too, since 2000. So you saw entrance of women into the workforce for a long time. But then, since 2000, women have been following the same pattern down. So the United States has had this much worse for both men and women. I'm just going to show you the charts for men. This is the decline in the labor force participation rate from 1990 to 2015 for OECD countries. The largest decline was in the United States, with the exception of Italy. And that's brought our labor force participation rate down to the lowest of any of the economies except Italy and Israel. And you see a similar thing for men. That tells us, and we can pick up more of this on the Q&A if people are interested, that part of this is in some things that are just going on in the United States and aren't happening elsewhere. The degree of incarceration in the United States is a much, much higher rate than any of these countries, and we do too little to incorporate ex-offenders into the workforce. The opioid epidemic is something that is much more unique to the United States than elsewhere, and recent research has highlighted that as an important cause as well. And finally, we spend very little on training, education, community college, a whole set of things which have been proven to help this. So I want to conclude by briefly saying a little bit about what we can do about this. We can raise productivity, education, business tax reform, trade, investment, bring down the deficit and immigration reform. Happy to talk more about any of those in the Q&A. We can help ensure growth is shared, and no, that wasn't a mistake on my part that I wrote education again, minimum wage, unions, and a more progressive fiscal system. And we can enable more people to work, yet again, education being an important part of the answer, training, support for work. That's things like wage subsidies, for example, an earned income tax credit for workers without qualifying children, and wage insurance that would help protect especially older workers if you lose a job, get insurance for the next one. I think ideally you do some combination of all of those. You tell people, we're going to take a step to increase growth, but we're also going to not assume that that's automatically going to get shared with everyone. We're going to affirmatively make an effort to make sure that that growth is shared, and in particular work very hard on incorporating people into the workforce and into working. The last issue is what is actually being done about the slow growth of middle-class incomes. That's your chance to ask questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jason, for that very interesting presentation. I look forward to a great Q&A. As a reminder to our audience, you have white cards on your table, so please don't hesitate to fill those out. They'll be brought up to me or tweet us at EconomicClubIN. And while I'm waiting for your questions, I'm going to start with a couple of my own. Okay, so you talked about the three factors behind the slowing growth of our economy. And one of the things you talked about was decline in the labor force participation rate for prime age men, ages 25 to 54. and you briefly mentioned opioids and some new research. So Princeton economist Alan Krueger recently published a paper just a couple weeks ago, I think, entitled Where Have All the Workers Gone? And the paper found that nearly half of prime-age men who are not participating in the labor force take pain medication on a daily basis. And nearly two-thirds of those who take pain medication take prescription opioids like Vicodin, oxycodone. And even more troubling, he found that labor force participation has fallen more in areas where there's relatively more opioid pain medicine being prescribed. So what do you make of these findings? And how worried should we be about the opioid crisis?
Yeah. I think this is a really important paper that you're referring to by Alan Krueger, and it brings together two things. One is this labor force participation issue that we've been talking about, and it's an issue that I think has gotten too little attention. It's gotten more in recent years. I think part of why it got too little attention is up until 2000, labor force participation was increasing overall because women were entering the workforce, and people who looked at the aggregate data weren't that worried. If they'd been looking beneath the data, they could have seen this a while ago, but that's happened more lately. And then a second issue, which is the opioid epidemic, which in our second term was a big focus, and it's something that President Trump has spoken out about a number of times as well. And what's striking in this research that Alan has is how closely these two are linked. Now, I won't get into the technical details here. I think his paper is more convincing on the correlation than it is on the causation. So is it you lose your job and you go on opioids, or you go on opioids and then you lose your job? I think the answer is probably both, and that it's a vicious cycle. But it does open up that, you know, some of thinking about what we need to do for the economy isn't just the conventional economic workforce training, et cetera, but we need to be looking at, you know, the way we prescribe medicine, the way we help people deal with addiction, the way we help ex-offenders, you know, a whole range of category of more social issues, I think are really at the fore in dealing with this issue.
Great.
And I was glad to hear how much you're working on them.
Yes, so. Yeah. I think it's an all hands on deck. It's got to be to try to tackle it. I've gotten a lot of questions, some of which are covered in the next one that I prepared that I want to make sure we address, because you had a great op-ed in yesterday's Wall Street Journal about the GOP tax plan. So President Trump was in Indianapolis last week talking about his vision for tax reform, and the plan has been praised by some who think it will lead to more investment and wage growth, and others have criticized it and say it's going to add to the deficit and the federal debt, including yourself. So I think before we get into your views on the plan and then your thoughts about what else we might consider doing, I'd just like to hear from you about the need for tax reform. Do we actually need to simplify the tax code? Why are we talking about tax reform?
Yeah, I think tax reform is a really top priority issue. I worked on it a lot in the Obama administration. Our business tax rate is the highest of any of the advanced economies. We tax international income in an utterly idiotic way where we raise no revenue at all while imposing substantial distortions. And we also have a lot of other loopholes in the system as well. So I think we need tax reform. That's not the only problem we have in our country, though. I think the deficit is an issue, inequality is an issue, and, you know, we probably have a bunch of other ones too. So I think we should address the tax issue while not making other problems worse. We shouldn't make the deficit worse just to solve problems in the tax system. We shouldn't make inequality worse. I think that's straightforward to do that. The House Republican plan last year actually was pretty good on the revenue neutrality. Wasn't so good on the distributional neutrality, so you'd have to fiddle with the rates some. There have been a number of other plans. Ways and Means Chair Dave Camp came up with one. President Obama had a framework for business tax reform. So I think this is something that can be done. What's dismayed me is that when President Trump came here, he didn't talk about tax reform. He talked about tax cuts, big tax cuts, massive tax cuts, big tax cuts, et cetera. And I view that as, at best, making one problem better, which is the tax rate problem, and making another problem worse, which is the deficit problem. And when you do the macroeconomic analysis of the net effect of those two, it usually works out the worst for us. Maybe at first it would help the economy, but over time it would chip away at the economy. So What I would urge those of you, especially in the business community who are credible on this, is say, you know, if it's truly revenue neutral, great. And that's what the Business Roundtable called for. That's what's in the president's budget. That's what Senator McConnell called for. That's what Speaker Ryan called for. If it's truly revenue neutral, great. We'll support it. But if it's not revenue neutral, then we won't, because right now, maybe we're not going to have a big fiscal deal to bring down the deficit, but at least we can avoid digging the hole any deeper. And then the next question is, who's judging that revenue neutrality? I think the nonpartisan scorekeepers at CBO and JCT is who I would go to judge. You know, if we needed to have my former thesis advisor, who was President Bush's top economic advisor, Greg Mankiw, do the judging, that would be okay with me too. Can't be, though, that you cherry pick whatever outfit in D.C. is going to give you the numbers you want. We certainly didn't do that when we were passing things. We live by the CBO numbers, whether we like them or not. That's the way I think it should be done here as well.
I have a couple more on taxes, but I think there's another one that might be more interesting that allow you to dig into some of what you were talking about earlier in your presentation, which is equality, inequality. You talked about the negative impact of inequality on the U.S. economy, and you talked very briefly about one of the solutions to that from a policy standpoint is increasing the minimum wage. Seattle, Washington is considered the poster child for those who favor minimum wage hikes because the city council there passed a law in 2014 requiring an increase in the minimum wage to $15 by the year 2021. A recent study came out of University of Washington that found that the law had resulted in a decrease in the number of hours worked for those with the higher wages and a decrease in jobs. So curious what your thoughts are about that, those findings, and then how should policymakers be thinking about tools like raising the minimum wage to get it more to where you think it ought to be to help spur growth?
So I'll get to that study in a moment, but why don't I give you my broader view on minimum wage, which is I think raising it would make sense. It's $7.25 an hour. It's been that for nearly a decade now. The real value has eroded a lot. It's much lower than most of the other advanced economy, lower than any other advanced economy relative to average wages in our economy. And I think the evidence from a lot of different studies are that the employment effect is relatively small, that basically you have a higher cost of hiring someone, but you also have more productivity, motivation on the job. You can pass some of those costs along. Some of it comes out of profits, and the net of all of that is a relatively minimal employment effect. I think that. I also think there's a limit to how much you can raise it. And that limit is even more so at the federal level, where you should think of it as not what's the right minimum wage for the United States, but what's the right minimum wage for Mississippi and New Mexico. And for Mississippi and New Mexico, it's not $15 an hour this year, next year, and probably not the year after either. So I think there are limits to this as a tool. Economics doesn't know really well yet where those limits are, and that's concerning. So I'm very supportive of, as these experiments are happening in cities and states around the country, really rigorous evaluation of them so we can learn from them where we should be going. The Seattle evidence, I think there were two different studies. One found no effect, the other found a large effect. I don't think either study was very good because Seattle's going through a very unusual economic time right now, and it's hard to tell how much of the decline in low-wage jobs was those people moved up and got better high-paid jobs or lost their jobs entirely, and it's hard to construct an appropriate control to test those two hypotheses. I think the study, if it had followed the same workers over time, would have been stronger. It just looked, though, at an average group here and an average group there and compared them. So, you know, unfortunately, we haven't learned that much yet, but my mind is open for when we do.
I've received a number of questions about your thoughts on the role of immigration and immigration reform and the role that immigrants can play in helping to improve our economy.
I think the single most important quantitatively large economic lever we have is immigration reform. And it works on two parts of the economic challenge we have. One of the challenges we have is that demographic challenge of slowing workforce growth because the population is aging. Bringing in new people is a great way to help deal with that. But even more important is immigration has been proven to be associated with faster productivity growth. Immigrants at a high skill level patent more than non-immigrants, and they make the non-immigrants they're working with more innovative as well. They're more likely to start businesses. They're more likely to make bigger investments in the community. And at the low-skill level, immigration reform would help there too, because the debate about the undocumented isn't should we have 11 million undocumented here. They're going to be here no matter what. The debate is in what manner are they being treated. And if they're on a path to citizenship with the authorization to work, they can be in the right jobs for them, maybe going to school, maybe making investments, maybe starting businesses. If they're hiding in the shadows, they're not going to be making their maximal contribution to the economy as well. So I think bipartisan immigration reform is one of the best things we could do. And the direction we've seen taken in the last 6 months, I think might be the most consequential, medium and long term negative to the economy from this administration's policies.
Let's switch to another hot topic, healthcare. The attempts to...
Another non-controversial one.
Non-controversial. Maybe world peace will be next.
That I don't have any views on.
Okay, good. So let's start with some facts. Healthcare spending accounts for almost 18% of U.S. GDP and outpaces GDP growth. One way to contain spending is to help people receive preventative healthcare, which is close to impossible for people who don't have enough income, disposable income, or insurance. Under the Affordable Care Act, the number of uninsured Americans dropped from about 44 million in 2013 to about 28 million at the end of 2016 through the expansion of Medicaid, here in Indiana, the expansion of HIP 2.0, and then by providing subsidies on marketplace exchanges for individuals below 400% of the federal poverty level. But we continue to see premium increases. It's been about 5% per year annually for 4 years, and that's projected to be 5% next year for employer-based programs. And the latest that I saw was that there were some projections the exchanges could go up by as much as 25%. So you were probably very involved in the creation of the Affordable Care Act and the implementation and all of that. So we'd love to get your thoughts about whether you think it just needs more time, whether this is an implementation issue, or if we actually do need to make some pretty substantial reforms mm-hmm. to make it affordable and better in terms of covering care.
So I plead guilty on the ACA. There's two sets of debates there. One is how you want to cover people, and that's been a really ideologically loaded debate. There's another is what you want to do on the cost side. Now, there's some relationship between the two, but not complete overlap. So I think we could potentially make a lot of progress on the cost side. And the thing to understand about the cost side is the Affordable Care Act took an approach which centered around, in Medicare payments, reforming them so that instead of being fee-for-service, where you pay for each of the inputs, it would be focused on paying for outputs. So rather than treating every test you get along the way, you get paid for treating someone for a cardiac episode or for replacing a hip. If you do a good job, maybe you get a bonus. You do a bad job, maybe you get a penalty. But you do a lot of extra duplicative tests, you're not going to get reimbursed for that. And so that was an idea that had been around for a while. We put it in the Affordable Care Act. 5 years later, Congress passed another piece of legislation. This time, it was spearheaded by then-Speaker Boehner, passed overwhelmingly support from both parties in the House and Senate, to take that same payment model and expand it and build on it and use it for physician payments as well. So I think that idea is one that if you look at wonk circles on left and right and you look at politicians, there's been a lot of support from both sides. Now, what both of those legislation, the Affordable Care Act, this other legislation called MACRA did, wasn't figure out how to solve this problem. I gave you the thumbnail 1,000-foot. But how you actually implement it is really complicated. You need to look at every different health condition. You need to figure out how to price it, how to define success, how to, if it's a bundled payment, figure out what the bundle is. But HHS has a lot of tools to do that. And so I think it's really important that they're using those tools as aggressively as possible, pushing forward with, they have a lot more discretion now in how to deal with these payment reforms than before. So that's the main thing I do. I think there's other things you could do. The way we do cost sharing in Medicare is completely crazy. There's lots of stuff that is basically free that probably shouldn't be. At the same time, your catastrophic costs, we don't pick up in Medicare, even though that's now required for private insurance. So some things that give patients, you know, more skin in the game has been a longstanding conservative idea and one that I think could play a role in helping in Medicare.
You talked a lot about the role that education can play in solving the issues that you identified in your presentation.
I was just sucking up to you and, Al and everyone else, all the educators here.
Actually, I heard you saying at the reception that was kind of the key to everything was education. Mm-hmm. And part of the issue is that we're asking more of our education system than we did 40 years ago. You mentioned universal high school and all the changes dating back from decades ago. And we want to make sure that our education system is actually helping to educate and graduate students who are prepared for 21st century jobs and college, post-secondary education. But so many of our kids are failing here in Indiana and elsewhere around the country. So tell us your thoughts about what are kind of the big changes you think need to happen in K-12, early childhood, and or post-secondary education to really try to get at some of the improvements that you recommended for us.
Okay, so first of all, I enter into this topic with some trepidation because you know what you're talking about, so just indulge me. I think each of these levels has somewhat different issues. For preschool, I think it's pretty simple. We are not spending nearly enough money in this country, and as a result, we have a lower fraction of our population in high-quality preschools than, you know, Chile and Mexico and 20 other OECD, you know, rich advanced countries. We're just not going to preschool, and when we do, not high quality ones. And the idea that, you know, we aspire to be a country with a quality of opportunity that at age 3 you set out on very different foots is something I think is wrong and something that, you know, I'm sure there's a reform agenda and there's other things there, but, you know, it's not something that can be done completely on the cheap, and that's something we need a program for. K through 12, I think, is a little bit different. We are spending a lot in that area. I think there's a lot more scope for, are we spending it better? Are we doing, you know, I think school reforms that I know you've championed, Al, probably many others here, can play an important role in that regard. I do think there's other issues like how schools get funded. That the United States, unlike other countries, they're funded at the local level, so poor areas have the worst funding and rich areas have the best funding, and that also is another thing that goes against equality of opportunity. For college, the biggest issue there is, first of all, college completion, which you had mentioned in your question. And the student debt problem is not a problem of people that have graduated from decent schools. The student debt problem is primarily a problem people who have dropped out from school, get a bunch of the debt, and don't get the benefit of that education. So more sort of on-the-ground steps to help people stay in school. But then I think student debt, the right thing to do there is to have some type of more aggressive income-based repayment. So if your income ends up high, you pay back all your student loans. If your income's low because you're unlucky or didn't get a job, you don't need to repay as much. And we have something of that type. We expanded it some. But we could expand it more. And then the last cycle of all of that is training. And we do very little training, at least very little federally funded training in this country compared to other countries. So I think that's another place where, you know, we just need to be investing more. Now, the fact is training programs have a mixed record in terms of what their returns are in placing people into jobs. And I use the word mixed very precisely. Not a bad record. They have a mixed record. Some of the programs are good, some of them are bad. So it's a place where you are less good. And so it's a place where I think you really need to be pretty hard-headed, evidence-oriented, and make sure you're scaling up and investing in what works.
I have a great question as you reflect back on the time that you spent in the White House with the Obama administration. Is what do you think was your greatest accomplishment during that time that you were directly involved in, you think made a big difference in our country?
I mean, I'm certainly very proud of the Affordable Care Act. I think it addressed one of the very biggest problems that our country had in terms of the number of uninsured and gave us the tools to deal with the cost side.
Okay, great. You talked, especially talking about it in your introduction, about the need for rational discourse on these very complex issues. And it's important to get in the room with others with whom you might disagree and try to work through these issues for the good of everyone in the United States. So if you were a betting man, how likely is it that we're actually going to achieve meaningful healthcare reform or tax reform? I've heard some predictions of by the 2018 elections or even by the next set of elections. How likely is that?
Yeah. I mean, on the rational discourse thing, I mean, I really do find it just very dismaying. And you know, it's bad for the world, but it also makes people stupider. You know, if you just spend your time talking to people who agree with you, you're never going to hear any of the arguments against your own view, and some of those views are, you know, going to end up either being wrong or maybe you're even right, but you can't explain why you're right. So I think that's a big problem, and I think, you know, from my critics, I've learned both better arguments for what I believed, and I've also learned that some of what I believed was wrong. In terms of tax reform, I put a very low chance at what I would describe as tax reform, a broader base, lower rate, don't raise the deficit type of reform. I put higher odds, but probably more like 40% on some type of big tax cut that I think would be bad for our economic future passing. And I don't think anyone has consistently lost money by consistently betting against things happening in Washington. So that's where I would put the majority of the odds. I guess I'd probably say about the same on healthcare.
So are you more likely to be cast in the next Jason Bourne movie than for us to have tax or healthcare reform?
Exactly. Look, I mean, healthcare reform, though, there is a set of, you know, Patty Murray and Senator Alexander and Senator Murray, Democrat and Republican, have been working together on a bunch of tweaks that would take away some regulations, that would make permanent or at least give some predictability to the cost-sharing subsidies that are a legally contentious aspect of the Affordable Care Act. And so I think it's possible that the two of them could end up reaching a deal. It won't be earth-shattering, change everything in our health system, but it'll make some tweaks and improvements. And, you know, a lot of times that's the right thing to do. There's some problems we know how to solve right now. There's other problems that we don't know exactly how to solve, so you need to do a bit here, a bit there, and build on it. I think health is probably a little bit more in that second category than that there's some single big answer that we could go out and do tomorrow. You know, climate change is in there's a single big answer. You know, you do a carbon tax, you reduce regulations, you rebate the money to people or the tax system in some form, and, you know, most of my friends in the economics profession and national security from left to right would agree with that plan. So climate change actually is an easy problem to solve. Our healthcare system, I don't think, has an easy answer, so we need to keep doing small stuff that builds on each other.
You're in a room with business leaders and other leaders from around central Indiana and elsewhere across the state. So when you think about the unit of change to actually help things happen effectively and efficiently, what advice do you have for us in Indiana about change that we might, you know, take the lead on in terms of healthcare, education, tax, everything else we just talked about today?
You know, I said you don't lose money betting against things happening in Washington. And when it's the things I like, I'm sort of upset about that. When it's the things I don't like, I'm sort of happy about that. But, you know, it's not always a terrible thing because we don't always know the answer. We're not always ready to do some big dramatic thing in Washington. Part of how we figure out the answers is experimentation at the state level. Is states doing, you know, really creative and interesting things? Some of the things that I had a chance to talk a little bit to a few of you about involving the workforce, community development, education, and the like. So I think, you know, a little bit of trying to be a little bit less preoccupied with Washington. Now, I don't follow this advice myself, so take it with a grain of salt. A little bit less preoccupied with Washington, a little bit more, you know, what can you do here that actually gets done? And especially then, what can you do here that, you know, when people get their act together again in Washington, they could take some lessons and learn something from, I think would be, you know, one way to help make change.
Well, it's been an honor speaking with you. Thank you for all your perspectives on these incredibly complex and challenging issues. And we are so grateful that you came to spend your lunchtime with us today in Indianapolis. So please join me in thanking Jason.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. So once again, I'll close with a few housekeeping remarks. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Saturday, November 11th, and it's also available for download on WFYI.org. Please join us next month, Martha Hoover, the founder and president of Patachou Incorporated. Don't miss the opportunity to hear from one of Indianapolis's own, who took her passion for food and developed restaurants that are acclaimed locally and nationally, while also serving her community through building a philanthropic foundation that provides educational services and more than $50,000 in food donations to local aid organizations. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters are found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you again, and have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to a speech from the Economic Club, part of the 2017-2018 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a presentation from Martha Hoover, founder and president of Patachou Incorporated. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.